we're going to hear from Marcy Cohen. Marcy's about to retire from her position as the Director of Research and Policy at the Hospital Employees Union, a union that saw massive restructuring over the last 8 years. She's also been the chair of the board at the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives in BC for those last 10 years. And in her role as a research associate with both the CCPA and HEU, Marcy is co-author of a number of research and policy studies looking at gender equality issues, living wage, health restructuring and privatization, and public solutions to the current challenges in the healthcare system. Marcy was a student at SFU in 1969 and 70, and has been involved in social justice issues for most of her adult, I would say all of her adult life. This says most, but I think all is appropriate. Take it away, Marcy.
Okay, so this is kind of fun to go back in memory lane, and my memory's not so good. But Mort, you helped a lot. So when Rochelle asked me to do this, my first thought was that we're living in a really different time now than we were then. And how was I going to talk about the lessons? And so what I really think is to sort of understand what that political moment was and what political moment we're in now and see what we can learn when we think about things in that way. So that's kind of what I want to do. My kind of reflections on SFU are a little more personal and scattered, and I'm just going to give you a flavor of the times. So I was from Calgary as opposed to Edmonton. And I grew up there in the 50s and 60s, and I sort of considered myself to be a refugee from Calgary, like, get out, right? My parents were Jewish, and although they were quite progressive, they were from Saskatoon, they met because they had socialist leanings. But in Calgary in the 50s, no one talked about politics. It was the McCarthy era. My dad was a liberal, and that was even more radical than being a conservative in those days. My mother was a stay-at-home housewife, who I learned much later was pretty unhappy in her role. And although I didn't realize how deeply troubled she was, I knew that I didn't want her life or that of my older cousins who, you know, got married at 19 and had kids a few years later. I wanted out of all that. So I was very much like, you know, that boomer generation, the beginning of that generation that wanted something different. And I remember in university, I did my undergraduate work in Calgary, and the first thing that inspired me and touched me sort of, you know, in going to university was hearing an African-American woman talk about the civil rights movement. And that was kind of what got me started. And I got involved in the peace movement and eventually the student movement. I went to Toronto for a year, came to Vancouver, worked for a year, and then I wanted to really get into politics. And to really go into get into politics at that time, it meant going to SFU. So I registered for graduate school with no goals really in terms of educational. It wasn't about the education, it was about student activism. But I did get an education. It wasn't an education in the classroom. It was clearly an education in the meeting rooms. And I remember speaking at to the student group in the cafeteria one noon hour about one issue or another. And I remember feeling like, you know, finally I had come to some place where I'd found a language and a way of expressing myself that made sense to me. Like, this was like so different. And, you know, I'm sure all of you have had that same experience where you've come to a place where this is where you belong and this makes sense. But, you know, if truth be told, actually, women did not have a very big role in the student movement. We weren't really among the leaders. We did a lot of the work, but that was a real contradiction at the time. The student leaders were all pretty well men. And I remember during the PSA strike at one point, we went in and we would disrupt classes, trying to encourage people to join the strike and not continue with their classes. And there was injunctions against us. And I was the only woman who got an injunction. And we had a demonstration outside with the injunctions, and all the women were yelling, "Injunctions for women, injunctions for women." So that gives you a sense of kind of, you know, our desire to be recognized as leaders that we didn't feel was happening. And What I was involved in, and Maggie Benston, who's this building's named after, and many other women, is really starting to meet separately as women and starting to talk about an autonomous women's movement and moving down the hill and starting Women's Caucus, and from which came the abortion caravan and a lot of union organizing, including some of the organizing up here. So, you know, that's kind of some personal reflections. If I sort of think about the issues that we were on about, it's interesting because they are actually some of the same key issues that we need to be on about now. I mean, democracy and inequality. So, you know, the issue of the PSA democracy was, you know, in its most full and radical form, but there was, you know, students having a right to evaluate their teachers at that point. There wasn't those rights, and those have been entrenched now. Students on Senate, students, we got student ombudsman, the whole role of students in any way having any say, much more limited than what the PSA department is, but that was certainly one of the motivations behind what we were doing here. And the other was the whole thing of the financial barriers to education, the student loans, but in particular the occupation and the inability of working class students to transfer from the college system to the university system and wanting to open that up. So, you know, if you think about what I'm working on now, you know, in the CCPA, it's inequality issues and it's a lot of it's democracy issues. Same issues, very different contexts, but same issues. So, you know, Mort mentioned, you know, what the moment then was. I mean, it was there was a liberatory dynamic, as he put it. There was a worldwide student movement. There was the civil rights movement in the States. There was the anti-colonial movement. We thought at that time that, you know, that anything could happen. Like, there could be a revolution. We could make huge differences. We had a sense of empowerment that we could actually have an effect on society. And it's a very different time than now. And so I just want to talk about now, because clearly, you know, if you think about now, there is at least as much and more imperative to act, but a lot more constraints. So there's sort of four points that I want to talk about in terms of the differences, in terms of what it means around organizing. So the first I want to talk about is the growing inequality in our society. And I just the other night heard Neil Brooks and Linda McQuaig speak. I don't know if any of you were there. But just this is some of the things that they said in that talk. That in the last 30 years, so since the 1980s, the top 1% of Canadian society has increased their share of the national income. So in 1980, they had 20 times more income than the median family. 30 years later, they have 200 times more income. And that's the top 1%. And if you go up to the top 0.1%, you know, it gets higher and higher and higher. So if you look at all the gains that have happened over the last 30 years, they've happened at that top end. That the median family, if you take the family that's sort of right in the middle, there have been no income gains. But during the same living, you have two people working. Often, when previously there was one person working or one and a half people working. So, and the poverty remains is equally entrenched, and BC certainly stands out in terms of that. So in terms of child poverty, in terms of, and a lot of that poverty, like half of those people are working, so it's not, you know, just the bad welfare system. Half of the people who are living below the poverty line are actually one person working full-time. So that's the context we're living in. What that means is that people have been really susceptible and found tax cuts attractive because it's the one way that they see any way of increasing their take-home pay. Mm-hmm. It's been a very effective strategy. So people have gotten attached to that notion of having tax cuts as a way of take-home pay. And, you know, that creates a lot of problems for us in terms of having enough money for education and healthcare, et cetera. So I just want to talk about the history because this kind of is a way of talking about the difference as well. If you looked at the 1% of top income earners at the turn of the century, so the turn of the 20th century, that is, so what was known as the Gilded Age, when there was runaway capitalism, the top 1% had 15 to 16% of the national income. There was no wealth tax, there was no income tax at the time. You know, that followed on the crisis of the Depression, of which there was a lot of progressive social policies put in place, a progressive income tax, a wealth tax. From 1930 to 1945, the amount that the top 1% had of the total national income went down to 10%. And then from 1945 to 1980, it continued to decline, so that by 1980, the top 1% had 7% of the national income. So that was a period of growing equality. And, you know, we know since then that's fallen apart. We have the rise of neoliberalism. We have the campaign for those, you know, strategic to capture more of the income and to blame the poor for the problems of the stagnation of the economy. And what all of it did was that by 2007, the top 1% was back up to 14% of the national income. So that's kind of what's happened. And, you know, so when we think back to the late 60s and 70s, we didn't realize it at the time, but we were riding a wave of growing equality in society. And we were pushing the boundaries of that, certainly. But, you know, that was the decade that Medicare came into place. That is the decade that all the funding happened for all the public education systems. So we were pushing the edge of what was a growing egalitarian society. In comparison to our current situation, which is very different, and which, as I said earlier, you know, there's an imperative to act, but we feel much more constrained. So I'm going to just talk about those constraints and how they tie to this top 1%. So the first is that people have a lot less time, students and everyone, and money to be politically active. You know, to be perfectly honest, when I was active, I was a graduate student, I had a TA salary, I had enough money to support me and someone else and, you know, to have a good time. I didn't have, you know, like to be...
They're going to glare at you now.
Yeah, it's true. It was a lot easier to be politically active, a lot easier. You know, what was hard, I think, is that we were against, we had no political culture and no history and nobody that came before us. But in terms of the ease with which, so we weren't very sophisticated and we didn't do very well at working out relationships with each other. You know, there was a lot of conflicts. But in terms of time, we had more time. And I think that's true for, you know, people, everyone, in terms of childcare, in terms of women working, in terms of the stress on people's lives. The other really important piece, I think, of this is the effect that the rich have had in terms of affecting the electoral system, corporate power, influencing government, the amount of money they put into elections, and the diminishing of democracy that we've seen as a result of that. I don't need to describe that anymore, but, I mean, there is a lot more media spin on everything. And so what that means is that, you know, there's governments operating in favor of special interests and people are less trustful of government policy. So the whole credibility of government and the whole effort by, as part of this campaign, to discredit government, the campaign to talk about the fact that we need to give those people who are talented and those people who are head of corporations more opportunities to, you know, take away the regulation and allow them to really be creative, all the things that people have bought into about what we need in our society, all have really worked to discredit government. And there's a really low level of trust of government policy, government action. And in part because government has really operated in a very ineffective way and has been very susceptible to special interests over the last many years. And so people are disillusioned with with politics, and they're susceptible to simplistic solutions and scapegoating, and we have the rise of the right and all that we know that that means. On the other hand, if you sort of look, you know, if you sort of take away those blinders and the way that which all of that has been worked out, and you look at reality, it is clear that egalitarian societies, ones that have more equal distribution of income, are among the most competitive economies in the world. They have and certainly the best health outcomes. So in those societies, children grow up healthier. They end up with lower health costs. And that goes through the people's entire life until they're older. And next month, somebody named Richard Wilkinson, who wrote Spirit Level, is going to be coming here and talking about this whole issue about more equal societies, better health outcomes, more effective societies. But that's, and his work at this point has gotten a very big audience. He was an academic, and at this point there's a lot of people listening, and there are a lot of people listening because it is the counter to the story that we and lie that we've all been told about how things work.
What's his last name, Richard?
Richard Wilkinson, the spirit level. Okay, so I want to say something about organizing and social movements and what it means right now. And, you know, there's always this challenge between the glass is half full and the glass is half empty. Mm-hmm. How much do you critique and how much do you talk about hopeful solutions, right? And, you know, the problem with critiquing is that you leave people with just feeling depressed and no hope, but it's what you think is reality, right? And then if you talk about the glass is half full, you know, you can easily have rose-colored glasses on, right? I listened to someone just the other day at the CCPA, and he's actually a professor here, Shane Gunster. Do any of you know him?
I know him.
Yeah. Very, very, very good. You guys should know him. He's in communications. Very smart, very progressive, really good. He talked about this research that's been done recently on the psychology of risk, and he was saying that, so when this research shows that narratives that talk about threats, you know, how bad things are, how the world is going to end, are immobilizing. And they do make people feel that making a difference is beyond what they can achieve. But it's different if you talk about risk as a challenge, so that you don't have rose-colored glasses on. You do talk about absolutely what's happening in the world, but at the same time, you tie it to what people have been able to do to mobilize. So you tie it to social activism and mobilization. And that the research shows that that actually gives people some strength and some courage to stand up and to do something. So that, I think, is a kind of useful way to think about. We do have to talk about how difficult things are, but we need to tie it all the time to the ways in which people have managed to resist and to stand up and to make a difference, to the politics of that, rather than just describing the litany of woes. Okay. And I guess I wanted to give an example here from my own union.
You got about 8 minutes.
Okay. So I work at the Hospital Employees Union. If many of you know, we had in 2004 all of our support services contracted out in a very, you know, the argument was support services, food services, cleaning are really ancillary hospitality services. They're not part of healthcare. They should be done by hospitality corporations and not by the health authorities, and therefore those things can be contracted out and people can be paid lower wages, and we can save money for what's important, which is the core services of doctors and nurses. And when we started out, we tried to do everything, and Karen was part of this, to counter the privatization argument. And we brought somebody from England where they'd done this, and we talked about hospital cleaning, and this person was not a union person, but she knew all the problems with hospital cleaning, because as an infection control nurse, so she described what difference it made having people who weren't part of the team anymore, and how different it was to actually set quality standards through a contract relationship, and that you couldn't really do that. When we took her to see the health minister, and we took her to see infection control nurses, and we did that, and we did a research report on what difference it made in terms of quality assurance, various things. We didn't win that. They contracted that out. At that point, there was two people in the opposition, and in the Liberal government, there wasn't much. They didn't need to pay much attention to us. But what we then had to do is we were living with contracting out, and the new workforce was 90% immigrant and visible minority, women mostly. And we organized them. And, you know, you couldn't just talk about how bad privatization is if you're going to now represent these people who are in working for the private corporations. And you can't just give up. So what we started to work on, which has been really successful, and it has success much beyond HU, is something called the living wage. So we looked at some work that had been done by a group called London Citizens, and instead of looking at what wages people should get based on the market, we looked at what wages people should get based on what it required for a family to support healthy child development, to pay their rent, and to not be in crisis. And so, you know, and then talked about it in terms of the value of having that. And so we actually worked with CCPA. We developed a wage which was considerably higher than the minimum wage. So the minimum wage was, we've been arguing it's $8 an hour. Everyone's been arguing it should be $10 an hour. This was looking at a family of four with two parents and two children, both parents working full times. When we first did it in 2008, the wage was $16.74 an hour. Now it's $18.71 an hour for each parent. That is basic, right? That is not a lot of extras. That is not saving for retirement. That is just getting, that's just making sure you're not in crisis and you can make a go of it. And arguing that that should be the sort of bottom line. We used that in our negotiations, and it really helped because we were able to do things that we weren't able to do otherwise. So normally, you know, you guys know about bargaining. You're then there with the employer and you bargain. But because we were doing something was talking about a living wage and we were talking about it in terms of child development, we were able to go to the health boards and talk and ask for a meeting where we said, we aren't here to negotiate. We just want you to understand why a living wage is important in terms of health outcomes for your patients and health outcomes for our workers. And so we were able to talk about the determinants of health and child poverty, and we had people from the outside who spoke with us. And then I did something about the issues around higher turnover and the lack of training and what it meant to have a low-wage workforce and how it threatened infection control. That we were able to have that kind of a reasoned discussion with the board, with each of the boards, health boards, which was not, you know, gave us a lot broader scope to talk than we would have normally had in bargaining. And that, along with organizing, which we did on the ground, and organizing our members who worked in their ethnic communities, and we got 15,000 signatures, and we presented them to Campbell. Oh, 2 minutes already.
Mm-hmm. That lost track of time. I was listening to you too closely.
Okay. Anyway, what happened there was just last summer, just when the election happened, sort of 2009, we managed to get, at the time when nobody was getting anything, we got 3% a year for 4 years, and you know, we're not up to where we were before, but it really was effective. And now we have living wage efforts going on in some municipalities. We have one health authority actually talking about living wage for the whole health authority, and it's something that's much beyond a coalition, that's much beyond the union. So it's a very positive kind of story in terms of, and it is that strong concept that makes a lot of sense to people in terms of what it has to offer. Okay, I have to be quick now. So the two other points I wanted to raise were, one is around democracy, and I won't go into the detail I was going to, but let me just say that we're doing some work on this in the CCPA now, and we were working with a framing institute from the United States who've trying to figure out how do you talk about raising revenues, increasing taxes, in a way that you're going to get some kind of support, right? I mean, we know that we need enough taxes to support education and to support the things that we need. And how in this climate, how in the hell are we going to find a way to get people to look at increased taxes? So they've done a lot of work on this. And, you know, it's clearly tying them to services and things that are really important to people. And there's lots of stuff about the language you need to use. But one of the fundamentals that they found was that you need to give people much more of a look into what government's doing so that, because of this lack of trust, people really need to be part of the decision-making process, and they really need to feel that this money is going to go where you're promising it's going to go. And so understanding how that budgeting process works and making that much more transparent and having a much more involvement, if you're going to put more money into anything, that's going to have to be an important part of it. So I think that whole issue around democracy and taxes and money for education is another thing to look at. The other is kind of organizing principles, which comes from the fact that a lot of us are organized now on, you know, the world is more complicated. When we were doing things, it was much more easy to get everyone's attention. Now, there's so many different pockets and different people working in different areas, hard to bring it all together and hard to get enough focus. So I think one of the really important organizing principles is an issue that really matters to a lot of people and framing what you're doing in terms of that. And really working to build relationships and coalitions. So one of the things that this group I learned about the living wage from in London when we first started this in the union was that they have really built they talk about power as being lateral power of relationships among a lot of different groups and sectors. So they have faith-based organizations and school organizations and health unions and a lot of different, and then they go out and talk to them about what their issues are. And then those are the issues they campaign on. And, you know, so it's, if they had to do listening campaigns first to see, okay, what are the main issues? And then those are the issues they campaign on. And it's based on really broad collaboration. Then taking that out in a stronger way possible. And when you get some wins, really supporting and rewarding the people that are supporting you. So it's a little short of time, but one of the things that they managed to get is they managed to get the City of London to be a living wage employer and to get the Olympics to be a living wage employer. And they did that by having meetings of 2,000 people at the time of the election from all different communities, each saying, you know, I'm from this church and I represent 700 people and I'm from this. So it was that, both the diversity, the coalitions, the relationships, and the size of the meetings that they were able to hold and visibility that they were able to get those commitments. And then they signed an agreement with the mayor about what they expected from him. So they acted, they were a community group, but they kind of acted like a union in terms of how they operated. That's kind of where I'm going to leave it, except to say that I do think that some of the strategic advantages you guys have in the university is doing some of this kind of, if I think one of your campaigns is around public education. Mm. I think that doing some kind of, quote, market research, but like what has resonance with people, the student body around education, getting some faculty who are progressive to help you do that research, so that you both know how to frame the issues, how to argue the issues, who in the student body supports you, who doesn't and why, could be really helpful and something to consider. And the other thing is just the advantage of building relationships with outside groups beyond the university, I think, is also really important. And to look at where people have been successful and try to model what they've done or what you can learn from that. So that, with that, I'm going to end.
Thank you, Marcy.